Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening. We begin tonight with breaking news. A little more than 11 years since President Obama told Americans about the raid that killed Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, and 21 years since the 9/11 attacks on this country, President Biden tonight announced the killing in a drone strike in Afghanistan of Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's second in command, and his successor. For more than two decades, he's been one of the FBI's most wanted, with a $25 million bounty for his apprehension or conviction. Tonight, that is no longer a concern.
We make it clear again tonight that no matter how long it takes, no matter where you hide, if you are a threat to our people, the United States will find you and take you out.
A lot went into the drone strike, and a lot may follow from it. We begin tonight with new details on how it all came together. And CNN Chief National Security Correspondent Jim Sciutto, what more have you learned about this mission?
Anderson, remarkable details coming out from a senior administration official tonight that speaks to a months-long intelligence operation preceding this strike from a drone on Saturday. We're told that the president was first alerted to Zawahiri's presence in Kabul in April, the start of April this year. But that had followed months where U.S. intelligence agencies had been tracking him, that he had moved to Kabul. Ostensibly, it seems, to stay with family there, a downtown villa. And then over the course of those months, the CIA and other intel agencies developed patterns of his and his family's behavior with the intention of finding an opportunity to kill Zawahiri in that home without injuring or threatening the lives of his family members or any civilians. And that took a tremendous amount of work and time. They say that the women who were living with him there followed their own tradecraft, that they would take routes home to this house that they thought would prevent them from being followed. In other words, they knew that there was a possibility that they might be followed there. There was a scale model of the house built so that the president could examine where Zawahiri spent his time and therefore make a judgment as to what munition was used, that it would only threaten his life and not the life of other people in that building. Ultimately, as it came down to it, they knew over time that he liked to spend time on his balcony outside. And on Saturday, it is on his balcony that the senior administration official says that a drone firing two Hellfire missiles struck him, killed the Al-Qaeda leader, but did not hurt or threaten the lives of anybody else in that building, which the administration is saying was a key concern of the president. But a months-long operation. One point I would make is this, Anderson, that following the U.S. withdrawal a little less than a year ago, August 30th of 2021, there had been a very open question as to whether the U.S. would be able to carry out counterterror operations to the degree it had while it had boots on the ground in Afghanistan. In fact, the CIA director had said publicly they would not have the same capability to do so. Over-the-horizon operations, they're more difficult. You have to rely on eyes in the sky, not eyes on the ground. But this is an operation that was successful doing just that. And that's a remarkable intelligence feat. It's a remarkable operational feat for this man who helped lead, you know, the greatest terror threat that this country has ever faced.
It's not clear, I mean, whether this was just eyes in the air. I mean, it seems like if they're fine, this is, I'm not speaking out of school, this is something the Taliban and everybody who's there would know. Anybody who's following people through the streets of Kabul, that's hard to do from the air, I would imagine.
Well, you can follow people from the air, certainly. Is it possible that the U.S. had contacts, the U.S. intelligence agencies had contacts on the ground? Certainly it is. It is also probable, frankly, that they were intercepting communications that would help them establish who was there and when and how. There's also this, and the president did not speak to this, nor did the senior administration official, but we do know that there was a $25 million bounty on Zawahiri's head. Mm. Is it possible that led to information that helped here. It's certainly possible. No one has said so. But I will say, in the past, those bounties have worked. It was bounties that led to intelligence that led to Uday and Qusay Hussein, Saddam Hussein's sons, when they were captured, when they were killed, I should say, in Mosul in 2005. Yeah. So we'll see as more details come out. But already we know of a tremendously intricate intelligence operation.
Yeah, Jim Sciutto, appreciate it. Thank you. Joining us now, CNN military analyst and retired Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, also retired Air Force Lieutenant General James Clapper, CNN national security analyst and former director of national intelligence, and CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward. Clarissa, can you describe the regional global significance of the U.S. taking out not just the current head of al-Qaeda, but someone who was so deeply involved with the September 11th attacks, even if some of it is just is not necessarily operationally all that significant?
There's no question that this is a hugely symbolic, significant moment. This is a man, as President Biden said in his 8-minute address, who had literally spent decades targeting, killing Americans, calling on other people to kill Americans, praising those who attacked Americans. He was Osama bin Laden's trusted deputy, his right hand. He had been able to continue, even while living in the sort of Pakistani hinterlands, to release audio tapes or the occasional videotape to try to keep coalescing support for al-Qaeda, keep calling for those attacks. And so when you think of this now, what are we, almost 21 years after the 9/11 attacks, it shows how far the reach is of U.S. justice. It is clearly an extraordinary feat of intelligence, as Jim was just elucidating, that they were able to kill him without any collateral damage, without any members of his family being killed. In terms of the sort of day-to-day significance of how this will change al-Qaeda operations, I think that it's a little too early to say, but unlikely to have a major impact on that. But it certainly minimizes their sort of global centralized authority and raises questions about who the next leader might be. There's all sorts of speculation already taking place about that. We don't know. I mean, one other thing I would add here, Anderson, that I think is deeply concerning and is going to be a big question for the U.S. going forward, in terms of how it sort of grapples with the Taliban and with Afghanistan and this new leadership, is the fact that he wasn't killed in the tribal areas of Pakistan. He wasn't killed in the border areas of Afghanistan. Right.
They were allowing him to live in Kabul.
In Sherpur, in downtown Kabul. This is like a few minutes away from the guest house that I was staying in last summer. So this is hugely significant that he was basically there at the largesse of the Taliban after they have made the Doha agreements, which explicitly forbid them using Afghanistan or allowing Afghanistan to be used as any kind of safe haven.
Yeah. Director Clapper, you were head of national intelligence when the U.S. killed Osama bin Laden. Can you just talk about the kind of intelligence that a president would have likely needed or wanted to give an operation like this the green light?
That's a great question, Anderson, and something I've been wondering about since we had to do this from, quote, over the horizon. And in the case of Osama bin Laden, obviously, we had his body and DNA analysis to prove that was actually him. So this was a, not to chest beat as an intel guy, but this was a tremendous intelligence feat. If as briefed, and if this was in fact Zawahiri and for example, not a double. But from the certitude of the president's statement, it appears that they're quite sure. What a president would look for, to answer your question specifically, is proof of life and proof as much as could be brought to bear that this person, whoever it is, Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden, it's actually him and he's present. I have to believe that Zawahiri let his guard down after the U.S. left Afghanistan, and because he was meticulous about his operational security, certainly during the Obama years and my time as DNI. And we had great difficulty trying to find him because he isolated himself quite successfully, both physically and electronically.
General Hertling, I mean, if what we are being told is what occurred, the mission was conducted with a drone strike. The idea that they were able to precisely target somebody at the time of day that they were choosing in part of their routine to stand or sit out on a balcony is really extraordinary, with limited, as Clarissa was pointing out, limited damage to other people who may have been in the house or in the neighborhood.
Yeah, it would seem so, Anderson. What I'm going to suggest, I'll add to what Director Clapper said. If you understand how these individuals do this kind of targeting, the requirement for intelligence, the requirement for rehearsals, which the president talked a little bit about tonight, and some of his team talked about how he was so interested in the intricate details of sunrise on the houses and what rooms were being revealed as this whole thing went on. You have to understand that these targeteers, these intelligence officials, the operators who conduct the operations have extensive, and I'm talking about they wake up every single day looking, how can we kill this guy? Because he is such a threat. And this has been going on for months. The average American doesn't understand the detail, the level of effectiveness and efficiencies that go into this kind of targeting of individuals that, you know, the president can stand up on the balcony and talk about the operation, but there have been months and maybe even years going into the targeting of Zawahiri. Mm. I first heard about this guy in 1998 when I was at the War College. We have been wanting to get him for a very long time. He is a leader within this organization. And the strike that was conducted was effective and efficient. Getting to your question about how do we know it's him? Well, what I'd suggest is it was conducted over the weekend, and Director Clapper knows this more than I do. They were looking for evidence of strikes. This is very different than that strike that occurred in August in Afghanistan. That was a rush strike to get someone who was threatening the organization. This was a long-term analysis and a long-term approach to targeting an individual that's been a thorn in the side of America for the last 30 years.
And Clarissa, we should point out that obviously there's a history with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that we all know about. The Taliban is fighting against an ISIS offshoot group in Afghanistan currently, but Al-Qaeda would have been aligned with the Taliban still.
Ideologically, absolutely. But what I think is still somewhat shocking about this, Anderson, is that, you know, when we were on the streets and talking to Taliban officials and talking to regular fighters as they took over the country, they were adamant that there was no way Al-Qaeda or any international terrorist organization was going to be able to get a foothold again inside of Afghanistan. And they understood how high the stakes were for them, because the whole notion of the Doha agreements is predicated on this idea that Afghanistan couldn't become a safe haven again. And yet here we are having this conversation in the wake of this momentous event, you know, one official telling CNN that they know that senior Haqqani Taliban figures were not only aware of his presence in this area, because this Sherpur area would be absolutely impossible for him to be living there without them being aware of it, but they also even took steps in the aftermath of the strike to try to conceal the fact that he was there, to try to restrict access to the house where the strike took place, and also to relocate his family. And so you're talking about the senior leadership of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, of Taliban-held Afghanistan, literally collaborating with Al-Qaeda after promising that they would not do that. And what that does to an already very damaged and dysfunctional relationship between the Taliban and the U.S., and how much more difficult that makes it going forward for the U.S. I mean, this is Zawahiri you're talking about, a guy with a $25 million bounty on his head. What happens when other individuals emerge, potentially, who are not perhaps as well known to intelligence officials, or who are not necessarily on the radar internationally in the same way? How can you trust again in the Taliban's word when they talk about a serious commitment to fighting not only ISIS-K, which they are focused on, but other groups like Al-Qaeda in the region?
The Coruscant Group is the K. Director Clapper, bounty, it seemed, when Jim Sciutto was talking about this earlier, in the past, bounties have worked. Director Clapper, I'm not sure if you can still hear me. In the past, bounties have worked in terms of getting people to give information.
Well, that's a possibility here. And again, I'm sure all these details, unfortunately, are going to come out in the next week or so, I'm sure. Whether there was someone on the ground that tipped off U.S. intelligence by some circuitous means, you know, to look for Zawahiri's presence in Kabul. I don't know the details on that, but yes, they have worked in the past and could have been a factor here. I don't know.
Yeah. General Clapper, appreciate it. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, Clarissa Ward, thank you so much. There's a lot more ahead to report on this, more to come on the breaking news, including discussion with retired general and former CIA director David Petraeus about the significance of the strike, as well as the intelligence requirements to succeed in a country firmly controlled by the Taliban. Later, dozens now dead from the flooding in Kentucky. Unbelievable images there. We'll have the latest on the rescue efforts, including an interview with a man who, along with his wife and his neighbors, helped rescue 9 neighbors, including 5 children. As we're getting more information from sources about the intelligence work that went in the missile strike on Ayman al-Zawahiri, this is what President Biden said during his speech about the intelligence involved in the operation, as well as conversations with allies.
1 week ago, after being advised that the conditions were optimal, I gave the final approval to go get him. And the mission was a success. None of his family members were hurt, and there were no civilian casualties. I'm sharing this news with the American people now, after confirming the mission's total success through the painstaking work of our counterterrorism community and key allies and partners.
Just before the president spoke, I spoke with retired General David Petraeus. He not only served as commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, he's also a former CIA director. General Petraeus, appreciate you being with us. What is your reaction to this news?
Well, it's very significant. It is a triumph for our intelligence community. It is significant that one of the original leaders of Al-Qaeda, a longtime international extremist and terrorist, has been brought to justice. It is perhaps, though, more symbolic, if you will, than it is of operational significance, noting that, of course, the real threat in Afghanistan, if there is one, of international extremism, is really the Islamic State affiliate there, the Khorasan Group. That is the organization that is fighting the Taliban as well, that is causing the instability in Afghanistan. And that's the one that we really have to keep an eye on, even as, again, this is a very significant takedown of a very, very long time and very significant extremist leader.
The other thing it shows is the capability, at least, of the U.S. To strike in Afghanistan, which was a question raised a lot in the wake of the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Then President Biden had talked about, you know, fighting kind of over the horizon. I'm wondering what, you know, we don't know a lot. There's not a lot of details about how this was conducted, but what would it take by way of intelligence, military coordination to accomplish something like this?
Well, obviously, you've got to get, if it is presumably a drone, you have to get it within reach of that drone's dwell time. We know that you can fly a drone from our bases in various locations in the greater Middle East and reach that location. Presumably, there were more sources put together than this, than just the drone footage and so forth. It does show, therefore, that it is possible to do over the horizon. I don't think anyone ever questioned, though, the ability to conduct over the horizon operations. It's more the ability to really have a dense capability to do this, to really get sources that would be on the ground and could actually develop the kind of partners and so forth that are needed and are still needed at this point in time, of course, to root out the extremists in the Islamic State Khorasan group, which, as I mentioned, are the ones that really pose the international threat. Again, noting that this is a very big operation. Again, this is the other real leader of al-Qaeda since the very early days, way pre 9/11, who stayed with it ever since.
How have the Taliban, I mean, first of all, I guess the Taliban knew he Zawahiri was living there and I guess approved that. What are their capabilities about the ISIS affiliate, against the ISIS affiliate?
Well, they're battling the ISIS affiliate.
Yeah.
They're also battling some of the resistance forces, as they're termed. Let me highlight something you just mentioned, Anderson, and that is, of course, that, again, the leader of al-Qaeda is located in Kabul, indicating clearly that in a way Taliban didn't learn the lesson from allowing, again, bin Laden to have a sanctuary on their soil when the 9/11 attacks were planned in Afghanistan. After which, of course, they refused to expel him from their territory. And that, of course, that's why we had to go in. So it does reflect the continuing close relationship that clearly still exists between al-Qaeda's senior leadership, that small group of Zawahiri and the others that is still left, and obviously the Taliban senior leadership. The fact that he was in Kabul, I don't think, is something that could have been possible without the Taliban knowing that he was there.
Is it clear to you why Zawahiri has been able to avoid being captured or killed so much longer than Osama bin Laden was?
Well, first of all, Osama bin Laden stayed essentially off the net for a very long time as well. And Zawahiri has essentially done what bin Laden did, which means that therefore he can't very capably lead the affiliates of al-Qaeda around the world. Essentially, they have been operating autonomously, independently. They may be part of the brand of al-Qaeda, but they certainly weren't under any kind of operational control. Again, noting that this is a very, very symbolic success to bring one of the last of the original al-Qaeda leaders who did so much damage around the world. Again, the East Africa bombings, yeah. A number of the other bombings in North Africa, other exhortations of bombings elsewhere, not to mention, of course, being a core part of al-Qaeda when the 9/11 attacks were planned.
And he was increasingly, I mean, he's one of the group who was sort of increasingly radicalized in Egyptian prisons, wasn't he?
That's true. In fact, he actually led the Egyptian Islamic Jihad prior to this, EIJ, in the 1990s. And it was in the late 1990s that he actually merged with Osama bin Laden. Again, they having met him earlier on the battlefields in Afghanistan, yeah, fighting the Soviets with the Mujahideen.
General Petraeus, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Coming up, well, more in our breaking news, the U.S. targeting and killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone attack in Afghanistan. We'll take a look at his life of terror next. Again, our breaking news, al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri is dead after U.S. drone strike in Afghanistan. In his remarks tonight, President Biden reminded Americans of the major attacks that he was involved in, 9/11, the bombing of the USS Cole, bombings of U.S. embassies in East Africa as well. CNN's Michael Holmes tonight has more on the man who, until this weekend, was one of the most wanted terrorists in the world.
I want to speak to the whole world. Who are we? Who are we?
By the time Ayman al-Zawahiri burst onto the world scene after the assassination of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, he was already a terrorist, committed to turning Egypt into a fundamentalist Islamic state. The young doctor came from one of Egypt's leading families. There is even an al-Zawahiri street in Cairo named after his grandfather. His uncle described him as pious.
He was known that he is a good Muslim who is keen to pray at time in the mosque and so, and to read and to think and to have his own decisions.
Al-Zawahiri spent 3 years in prison after Sadat's assassination. After he got out, he made his way to Pakistan, where he used his medical skills to treat those fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. That's where he met Osama bin Laden, and they found a common cause. He talked about it a decade later.
We are working with Brother bin Laden. We know him since more than 10 years. We have fought with him here in Afghanistan, and we are working with him in Sudan and in many other places.
Al-Zawahiri was many places in the early 1990s, even, it's believed, visiting California on a false passport. His group attacked Egyptian embassies and tried to kill Egyptian politicians. Eventually, Al-Zawahiri folded his group into Al-Qaeda.
Zawahiri pretty much led the group. He did the strategic policy of what Al-Qaeda's agenda was. Certainly, bin Laden gave his authority and blessings to it, but Al-Zawahiri called the shots.
Al-Zawahiri was at bin Laden's side when he declared war on America in May 1998. Weeks later, they launched an attack on US embassies in Africa and then gloated after they escaped a US cruise missile attack launched in retaliation. After the 9/11 attacks, Al-Zawahiri began to become the voice of Al-Qaeda, taunting the US.
American people, you must ask yourselves, why all this hate against America?
After the US invasion of Afghanistan, bin Laden and Al-Zawahiri were on the run, sometimes together, more often apart. His wife and daughters were killed in a US airstrike aimed at him. But he continued to issue messages on subjects ranging from the war in Iraq to the London subway attacks in 2005. And while he was always the likely choice to succeed Osama bin Laden, it took the organization several weeks to announce his promotion.
Zawahiri is not charismatic. He has not been, was not involved in the fight earlier on in Afghanistan. And I think he has a lot of detractors within the organization. And I think you're going to see them start eating themselves from within more and more.
Without bin Laden, Al-Qaeda can never be the same.
An idea personified by Osama bin Laden. He was this charismatic figure. To join Al-Qaeda, you pledged a personal oath to him. People went and died, not for Ayman Zawahiri or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but for Osama bin Laden.
Terror experts say that to jihadists worldwide, Al-Qaeda still has great appeal as an inspiration. And while Al-Zawahiri was an obvious successor to bin Laden, it's not at all clear who would succeed Al-Zawahiri.
That was Michael Holmes reporting. There's much more ahead tonight, including the possibility of yet more flooding in Kentucky, even as the death toll climbs and hundreds remain missing. My conversation with one man who helped save nine of his neighbors. That's next. Flood watches are in effect tonight across parts of central and eastern Kentucky, even as the death toll climbs now at least to 37. Destruction and flooding are preventing crews from reaching. Well, Kentucky's governor said today are hundreds of people still unaccounted for. There's new video tonight from Kentucky National Guard chopper crews shot during the worst of it on Thursday and Friday, which shows how isolated local valleys are from one another and how big a difference these well-trained members of the Coast Guard can make.
She's in the basket waiting for a thumbs up. All right, cable up. Okay. Clear to come up. That is hold. I don't want to fly off with her, with Soul Lady in the basket. Okay. 20 feet below. I am coming up, so.
You're not 7, Roger. 10 feet.
10 feet below. Roger. I got you. Cool.
Did you hear Wally's traffic
about? At the floor. I did. At the door, bringing her in.
And 880-097, we're doing a hoist over here. We found some people on a roof. We're probably about just 200 yards behind you in the valley.
That's from the Kentucky National Guard. One of many rescues these crews have carried out. Nathan Day, however, the man you're about to meet, didn't have any equipment at his disposal to do what he did and his wife did in the darkness of early Thursday morning. Tonight, nine neighbors, five of them kids, are safe because of it and what some of his other neighbors did as well. And I spoke to him just before airtime. Nathan, thanks so much for joining us. When did you know that something might be wrong?
I got up around 2:15 because I had to get my son off to work to make sure he got up to go to work. And I looked at my phone and I got up from my alarm went off and I had a text from a lady that told me to save her daughter and her babies, her grandchildren. And I didn't know what she was talking about, but I figured it was to do with the flood. But so I come out on my deck of my house, which is here, and All I heard was screaming.
So it's dark out and you're hearing screaming all around you?
Yes.
Wow.
And when I hollered for this lady named Tab, Tabitha is her name, her mother called her Tab, I hollered and then I heard the babies screaming on the roof. And
how far were they from you?
They are actually, let me get set here. No, it's bright. They were down there in the bottom, the house was. And the other house is right here where the other family lives.
Wow.
Did
you have a boat with you or any supplies?
Take you down. I mean, I went through the water.
You just went down by yourself through the water?
Me and my wife. And then when I got to them, I made them bring one at a time to me and get me, because there was a double-wide trailer down here off the hill, and they had their back porch was about 6 inches underwater. And I knew that I could get them kids on that porch because nobody lived there. Mm. So I could get the kids on that porch. Once I got them all across off the house and on the porch, then I put one under each arm and one on my neck, and just so happened the little girl that was on my back had her little dog with her. I didn't know it.
I understand at one point your head actually went underwater as you were trying to get them out.
Yeah. When I went behind the double wide, when I went behind the double wide, there's a ditch through there. And when I went to step across trying to find that ditch, I went under. The water was over my head.
And this is all happening in the dark. I mean, you're in the water with these kids in the dark.
Yes.
Wow.
I went straight off the mountain. And you just got to do what you got to do, you know.
I understand you got the help of your neighbors and rescued two former school teachers.
Yes, my second grade teacher, Miss Gayhart. And Miss Prater, my English teacher in high school.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, what I'd done is I knew them ladies was in that house. And them ladies mean so much to this community. They've probably taught everyone here, you know. And they just, they're godly sent women.
And I understand the second teacher had actually been watching the water rise in her home. I mean, she must have just been terrified.
Yes, Miss Prater was up. She went to the second floor of her house. But Miss Gayhart didn't have a two-story home, and she was on her kitchen countertop is where she was at.
Wow. It's just incredible. And, I mean, what a community that there are so many good people like you who are willing in the middle of the night
band
together.
That's one thing that that's one thing that I'm going to say about everybody in this area. I have seen so many people saving people. Mm. I've seen so many people out feeding people. And when I say this, I mean, guys, these guys have lost their homes. Mm. They've lost their cars. They've lost their whole life in a matter of just a few hours. I mean, they lost their whole life. I mean, it's sad.
Nathan Day, it's an honor to talk to you, and I appreciate you taking the time, and I wish you, your family, your neighbors safety in these days ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a neighbor. Up next, an unusual endorsement by the former president in a key Senate race, plus a look at Missouri's most controversial candidate, why some Republicans worry about their party's ability to take back the Senate if he wins the nomination. Just a short time ago, the former president offered his endorsement in a key Senate race in Missouri. He endorsed Eric, leaving it open for voters to choose between the two Erics who are actually in the race, one of whom, the former governor, Eric Greitens, resigned from office 4 years ago after a sex scandal and is now facing allegations of abuse from his ex-wife, which he denies. CNN's Jeff Zeleny has more.
Guys, we are on our way to victory.
Eric Greitens is seeking a comeback in Missouri.
And they've run a campaign based on fear. We've run a campaign based on faith and hope. Yeah. And the fact is that the country is in crisis.
He's not talking about rival Democrats, but fellow Republicans trying to block his second act. saying he's unfit for office and could endanger the GOP's chances of winning the Senate. On the eve of voting, the Missouri Senate primary feels like a hot summer mud fight.
Scandals, child abuse allegations. That's not conservative, but that's the real Eric Greitens.
With Republican groups spending millions in TV ads and rivals banding together against Greitens.
He will lose this seat. He's abused his wife and his kid, and he's quit on the people of the state.
Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt has been a leading beneficiary of the controversy. He told us the Senate seat is too important for Republicans to risk.
It's a 50-50 Senate, right? So the path, the majority for Republicans runs right through the Show Me State. We can't lose Missouri. The former governor is a quitter and would certainly jeopardize this race.
Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler said Greitens has brought disgrace and shame to the state and said she won't support him if he wins the primary.
No, I can't vote for him. You know, Missouri deserves better than that, and they can do better. I have that track record of conservative, courageous leadership that is needed right now. We're in a very bad situation in our nation.
The scandal dates back to 2018.
Good afternoon.
When Greitens stepped down as governor after acknowledging an affair with his hairdresser, she accused him of trying to blackmail her with partially nude photos he took, allegations he denied. At the time, his wife stood by him. Now they're embroiled in a messy custody battle. She's accused him of abusing her and their children. The former Navy SEAL has denied the allegation and sought to change the subject by literally taking aim at the Republican establishment.
Today, we're going rhino hunting. Join the MAGA crew. Get a rhino hunting permit. There's no bagging limit, no tagging limit, and it doesn't expire until we save our country.
He calls his critics rhinos, or Republicans in name only, in hopes of galvanizing conservatives. In all, 21 GOP candidates are running, including Mark McCloskey, who seeks to capitalize on the moment he and his wife pointed guns at protesters outside their St. Louis home 2 years ago. Tonight, Donald Trump's day-long promise of an endorsement brought little clarity. He punted on choosing between Greitens and Schmidt, saying, "I trust the great people of Missouri on this one to make up their own minds." If Greitens wins, Democrats believe they have a shot at picking up the seat, despite not winning a Senate seat here in nearly a decade.
We got to run different. We got to run against the system that's not working for everybody. And you got to be a warrior for working people.
I'm joined now by Jeff Zeleny. I also want to bring in CNN political director David Chalian into the conversation. Jeff, what more are you learning about this move by the former president endorsing essentially two candidates? How are Missouri voters expected to react to this?
Well, Anderson, I think they are likely to be left to their own devices, which is what the former president said in a statement. He said the good people of Missouri should make up their own minds. But what he didn't say is that he's clearly trying to save face here, not knowing which exact candidate to pick. He clearly is mindful of his own scorecard, as he has been throughout this primary season, as it's gone from May to June to July, now to August. He wants to pick winners. Quite simply, he doesn't know who is going to win in this contest. His family members are supporting the former governor, Eric Greitens. A lot of other Republicans are supporting the Attorney General, Eric Schmidt. So he came down to say he is endorsing the Erics, but basically leaving it to voters. And it's such the 11th hour, it is too late really to get a new TV ad up, et cetera. So both Erics were claiming victory tonight on the endorsement. But Anderson, the voters I talked to here are already going to make up their own minds. They know these candidates all too well.
David, what do you make of this 11th hour move by the former president?
Yeah, I mean, I think because he waited so long, it's a diminishing effect of what his endorsement could accomplish. And although he was clearly being lobbied and swayed from both sides here, I think he realized that he may not be the difference maker in this one, Anderson. So why take on the potential baggage of backing the wrong guy at the end of the day?
Jeff, looking ahead to the Arizona primary tomorrow, there's this proxy battle between former President Trump and former Vice President Pence. Both have been on the campaign trail for different candidates. How much is at stake for both?
Look, I think a lot is at stake for the former president, of course. The former vice president is clearly not as popular among the base. But I think the biggest thing at stake is the direction of the Republican Party in Arizona, one of the top big battlegrounds in this cycle. And the former president was out there just a week or so ago. He is endorsing Carrie Lake in the governor's race. And he is, you know, given his full throat endorsement, the former vice president has endorsed another candidate, as well as the current governor is also backing her, Karen Taylor Robeson. So at the end of the day, which direction is the party going to go? Make no mistake, it is still Trump policy, but it is a different certain type of a rhetoric, if you will. And Carrie Lake is as big of an election denier as it comes. So if she wins tomorrow in Arizona and some other candidates as well, that will certainly foreshadow a tough race, an interesting race come November.
And David, there's another key primary challenge in Michigan for one of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach the former president after the Capitol attack. What are you going to watch for in that race?
Yeah, Congressman Meyer is one of 10 Republicans who voted to impeach the president. He's one of three on the ballot tomorrow in primaries, Anderson, two in Washington state and Meyer in Michigan. His Trump-backed challenger, John Gibbs, is a total election denier as well, as promoted Donald Trump's lies about the result of the 2020 election, served in the Housing and Urban Development cabinet agency in the Trump administration. And he is the conservative choice here. Meyer's in the fight of his life. And Democrats, Anderson, are actually meddling in this Republican primary. They're spending money trying to pump up Gibbs because they think he'll be easier to defeat in November. But that's playing with fire, of course, because they're promoting a known election denier who could potentially win the seat in November.
Yeah, David Chalian, Jeff Zeleny, appreciate it. Thanks. We'll be right back. Randy Kaye joins us now for an update on a story we aired last week. Randy?
That's right, Anderson. Last Friday, we aired a story about the Wyoming Republican congressional primary and Liz Cheney's constituents. We asked the state Republican Party for a statement, which we shared on this program. They told us, quote, the Wyoming GOP doesn't take sides in the primary, and that they are, quote, neutral in this election. But that is not a true statement. As we have reported, the state party has, in fact, taken some clear anti-Cheney positions. We wanted to clarify that the party may not have formally endorsed a candidate, but it has not been neutral in this race. Anderson?
Randy, appreciate that. Thanks. The news continues. I want to hand it over to Laura Coates and CNN Tonight. Laura?
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.